Welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast from the Western Front Association, with me, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The WFA is the UK's largest Great War History Society. We are dedicated to furthering understanding of the Great War and have around 50 branches worldwide. For more information, visit our website at westernfrontassociation.com. It is the 1st of October 2025, and this is episode 365. On today's programme, I'm joined by Dr. John Black to talk about his research into a very unknown area of the Great War, the role of the Army Pay Corps and the pay services that administered pay to British soldiers during the First World War. Drawing on John's military background and academic research, he explores the role of the pay office and pay corps and how it was indispensable to maintain morale and functioning of the military during the war. John, join me from his home in England.
John, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you with us. Now, let's start with your journey. You served in the Royal Army Pay Corps, and now you're writing a book on the Army Pay Services in the Great War. What drew you to this under-researched field?
Just to amend that, I joined the Royal Army Medical Corps first as a boy soldier in 1962 and went off to a junior leader regiment in Sunny Rill for 2.5 years. And I served 2/3 of my regular service in the RAMC. I was an RAMC clerk, and I transferred to the RAPC because they were asking for volunteers to transfer to them. And I continued serving with the RAPC after I became a civilian. I was a student for 4 of my 12 years in the TA. It paid my beer money.
So now, one striking theme across some of your research is how quickly women were integrated into the army pay offices from 1914 onwards and throughout the war. What prompted this shift, and how did this actually play out in practice?
The origins of the women working in army pay offices first started in probably September, even earlier, August 1914. There's a pamphlet in the Imperial Museum Library called The Souvenir. And there's an article, 2-page article, about women from the garrison, Woolwich Garrison. So we're talking about the wives, fiancés, and other contacts with the garrison, who one day, 3 days after the war was declared, walked into the army pay office and said to the regimental paymaster, "We understand you are short of staff. We're here to help." And they were unofficial, and they stayed 2 months. And the regimental paymaster, Colonel Church, must have been impressed with them because he paid them, which actually was unlawful. Unfortunately, the War Office found out and ordered the women out. 3 weeks after that, the accounts one department in the War Office Finance Branch found itself so short that they started to recruit women officially. And by January 1915, women were being recruited into all army pay department establishments, particularly the 27 army pay offices in Britain and Ireland. And you can, if you look at it in sort of sociology terms, it can fit into women being the reserve army of labour, which it probably was. The women that were deployed settled down very, very quickly, because I think something's been lost in history about the national psyche at this time. You know, this was something that's never happened before. A great European military power, highly industrialized power, was taking on France, Germany, and Russia, equally highly industrialized. And Britain had a small army, and it had to catch up with France and Germany. First of all, recruiting, voluntary recruiting. It goes along with what voluntary recruiting. How much money do I get paid? And that's a valid question. How do you pay the soldiers, particularly when thousands of reservists have been called up and Kitchener's army was taken off? You know, the small army pay department of 800 before 4th of August 1914 didn't cope. And had it been left like that, the British army would have collapsed, because pay, money, finance is what keeps armies going, as well as catering and food. These are areas I think military historians have lost track of.
Yeah, no, I think it, you know, you just said something that's so obvious, it hadn't really occurred to me that, you know, if you don't pay the soldiers, they are going to go home because they need money to buy food, potentially stamps. They need to go out drinking. And if they've got no money, they're not going to be very happy. I mean, it sounds really obvious, but if your employer fails to get your salary in, it makes you somewhat challenged, I suppose, in a way.
Can I just...
Yes, please do.
Many of the Kitchener battalions were recruited from the northern industrial cities and also from Belfast and Northern Ireland, what's now Northern Ireland. Just before the First World War started, and from 1908 onwards, you had the big industrial relations problems, the what they called the Triple Alliance strikes of the three major unions, the railways, the coal mines, and transport. Those were the recruits that mainly went into Kitchener's army. They were militant. American historians written about them, he says that what I can't understand is in 1914, and the British working man was the most militant in the world. And also the British social strata was the most rigid in the world, a class structure. And I believe that there was no mutiny, no big mutiny in the British Army compared to other belligerent nations, was mainly because the army pay services were totally efficient. And efficiency is not a word you hear often about conditions, institutions, etc. in a great war.
Well, I think it's the very fact we haven't heard about anything underlies your point. I mean, that because again, it sounds obvious. My own area is combat motivation and morale in the armed services, certainly in the First World War, and I've never come across a problem with pay in my research, which sort of underlines your point that, you know, they were efficient because there was no problem. And it sounds obvious, but it's not, because trying to administer this massive expansion in personnel, this huge expansion in terms of bureaucracy, pay, and then plus you've got all the separation allowances which come in later, it's a massive administrative task.
Yeah, and you look at separation allowance, there was up until the second week of the Great War, in the second week of August 1914, the army had operated the regimental marriage establishment, and only a very few senior non-commissioned officers and senior regimental officers were entitled to marriage quarters and separation allowance. You could marry, but you could be off to strength. You got nothing. In the second week of the war, Prime Minister Asquith abolished temporarily for the war the marriage establishment. So everyone who enlisted who was married was entitled to separation allowance. Equally, all soldiers that were off to strength marriage were suddenly entitled to separation allowance. And I think Asquith has been underrated as a wartime prime minister. He actually established something that kept the motivation of soldiers voluntarily enlisting. No one wanted conscription. Conscription was the bogeyman in 1914, 1915. If we had conscription, we could have problems. But again, there was this money motive, and where you're paying a professional soldier a professional weekly wage and also looking after his family. And the scope of separation allowance also changed. It wasn't only legally married wives and soldiers' children. Common law arrangements were also treated the same. And you had soldiers living with women. You've had that since there's been armies. And they were being treated the same as if they were married to a soldier. And the expansion of separation allowance was the biggest headache in 1914 for the pay officers, because Asquith also said that is the priority of army pay officers, sort the separation allowance out. And everything else that had to be done was delayed, but they did it. And the women were coming in at that time. They were slowly trickling in. And by January 1915, a deluge came in. They were all coming in. And I've often wondered, why haven't historians picked this up before? When I was serving in the RAPC, I looked around to find out why the history of the RAPC, the Army Pay Services, had never been completed as an academic study. Everything else in the First World War has been done. People who were shot for cowardice, the medical services, infantry tactics, armored tactics with the arrival of tanks, but nothing to do with army finance, the payment of soldiers. I think a lot of academics in the system, in the military history, do not know how soldiers were actually paid. Where did the money come from? What was the chain of command from a vote in Parliament to the soldier's pocket? And there was this bureaucratic organisation that's been invisible.
Because John, I just wonder whether, I'm sorry to butt in, but you just raised a really good point. Could you tell us how soldiers were paid? I mean, I know this is slightly deviating from the questions, but it's a really fundamental question because I don't know. And how did the Army Pay Service function before the war?
Before the war, go back to the Second Anglo-Boer War, it was a total disaster as far as army administration was concerned. Soldiers' pay records were moved where the soldier went. So in the South African War, I'll call it the South African War from now, what happened was, their pay records got lost. Army pay staff became casualties. If a soldier moved from one unit to another, his pay records had to go with him. And the Boers raided trains, sabotaged the mail, everything. And there were many, many soldiers, particularly of the Imperial Yeomanry, part-timers, whose records were very scanty in the first place, that came home with outstanding balances, cost the public a lot of money. There was a paymaster called Major Claude Bray, Army Pay Department, who had observed the Indian Army, which was also partaking in the South African War. And he noticed the soldiers carried a blue book, which was a pay book. And it was a record of when the soldier was last paid. From that, he devised the Active Service Pay Book, the AB64, which was introduced in the Army in 1906 for the same purpose. It acted as another source of identity. It acted as a pay record. So if the soldier was a casualty in a hospital, the pay authorities would know what his rate of pay was and when he was last paid. And also, it had a will form in it. So if the soldier was killed and had made a will, it was accepted in law that that was a valid will. Bray also suggested that we should have army pay officers fixed at home, Britain and Ireland, where the soldiers' primary pay record is kept. He also said because before 1914, soldiers were paid using pay and mess book systems. And he scrapped that and said, we'll have acquittance rolls. And the acquittance roll would leave the army pay office and go to the wherever the command was, pay office. If it was on active service like the First World War, for example, soldiers in France, it would go to the command pay office, British Expeditionary Force, and it would be drafted out to field paymasters in each command, who would then filter out to the subordinates to regimental units, and it was it had the details of each soldier's pay, what they're entitled to, and it was up to regimental officers to actually pay the troops. The money coming through from the War Office Finance Branch through bank drafts, and there was banks, British banks in Calais, in Dieppe, and Rouen. So the money could always be drawn from there, and the soldiers were paid. The acquittance roll, when complete, there was enough for 4 weeks' pay on the acquittance roll. When 4 weeks were done, that sheet was returned by the chain of command back to the Army Pay Office, and the details of the payments were then recorded on a master sheet kept in a loose file, Kalamazoo file, which was loose leaf, and it was very capable of being done speedily, quickly. But the Army Pay Offices never had men because it's so, they fit. They would go in the infantry, and that's where women came in, the Reserve Army of Labour. And women, I think, were totally underrated before 1914, and women working in this office regime were totally efficient. It's routine work, it's admin work. Some sociologists call it the de-skilling of the clerical labour. Matuszewski's written about the post office women clerks in the 19th century. Well, whether it's de-skilling or not was a very interesting topic in itself. It worked. Yeah. There was always abundant supply of women, and say 30,000 probably served in the Army Pay Services in the home Army Pay Offices during the First World War. The women were temporary civil servants. They never wore a uniform. And one of the problems with military historians and also with regimental histories is I've got photographs, particularly of Chatham. The Army Pay Office at Chatham paid all the Royal Engineers, non-commissioned ranks, throughout the British Army. And I got a picture of 50 huts on the parade ground at the Royal Engineers Institute in Chatham. And I showed it to the curator if he was interested, and he was not, because it wasn't Royal Engineers. But it was the blood that kept the Royal Engineers in the Royal Engineers fighting, if you know what I mean. And I find that tragic, because you're cutting off a piece of history that I think is totally relevant to any other regimental history. Because behind every soldier, there was an army pay office. And behind every army pay office, there was a clerk looking after the finances of that soldier and his family. Because soldiers' files were joined up with slips, the slip system, the separation allowance, if he was entitled, was kept in the same loose leaf binder as his record. And we got to give thanks to the post office, who were the agent of paying separation allowance. They paid separation allowance every Monday morning.
And something I've read, this is slight deviation, is that what we know, for instance, if I joined up and I get a shilling a day, which is 12 pence in the old money, and I give 4 pence to my mother, would that be deducted by my regimental officer, or would that be noted at a pay office and similar deductions made and sent to my family?
Interesting case. Separation allowance entitlement, whether it's a wife, a common law arrangement, or somewhere else it's been agreed by the government, because it could be a parent or grandparent or guardian, as long as they were responsible for you before the war was declared. They were entitled to separation allowance, but the soldier had to be living in their home. And their next of kin, as it were, relied on his wages to survive. And he's suddenly in the army would keep that contract going. You have a certain case, and there's one that was a legal case, a soldier in the Essex Regiment, and he neglected his wife, he abandoned his wife. And his wife and family were thrown on the board of guardians in Croydon. And they wrote to the army pay office, the regimental paymaster at Worley in Essex, that was responsible for the Essex Regiment, amongst others. And the regimental paymaster, when it arrived in court, came with the, if you like, the legal answer, and he said, no, he's not entitled to separation allowance because he was not living at home or caring for his wife when he enlisted. He had abandoned them. But under the Manual of Military Law, it did say, this goes back to 1837, that if you abandon your family or you have a family, you must pay one third of your weekly wage to your family. That's above separation allowance. That was your legal moral duty to your family. So this soldier actually had to pay out of his 7 shillings and something a week, 3 and 4 pence to his family every week while he was in the army.
Now let's go back to all these ladies joining the Pay Corps in at the very start of the war. Now, were they drawn from the civilian side, or did members of the Women's Auxiliary Army Corps or the Queen Mary Auxiliary Army Corps join them as well? And if so, did they actually have sort of different cultures, and was there tension between these two groups?
You have to remember, okay, that the women's uniform services only began in 1917, when women had first walked into an army pay office at Woolwich in August 1914, and without permission, but with permission from late November 1914. These women were civilian; they were temporary civil servants. Now, I've not ever understood this. Why this was, but uniformed women never worked in army pay offices at home. However, from 1917 to 1920, women's auxiliary army corps clerks did work in the command pay office BEF because there's 3 casualties. And I don't know why that there was a division. And I don't know why women in uniform were not included to work in the army pay offices in the United Kingdom. In the record offices that kept the soldiers' personal records, which are often in the same campus as the army pay offices, W Women's Auxiliary Army Corps clerks did work in them, but not the army pay offices. And I never found out why. So if anyone out there can help me with that one, I'll be extremely grateful.
Now, some of your work, you touch on Hut 47 at the Army Pay Office in Chatham, and you talk about the sort of vivid picture of their life. I wonder whether you could tell us, what was Hut 47 and what was it like working in these offices? And what do some of their informal publications tell us about what they felt and how they got on with their work?
Well, I met the son of it's about 20 years ago. I met the son of Gwendolyn, who was a civilian clerk in the Army Pay Office at Chatham, and I got a photograph of her outside the office, Hut 47. There were 50 huts on the Royal Engineers Institute parade ground. I bet the RSM was quite annoyed about that. But it shows you the size, you know, the expansion. Yeah. And I have a picture here. A Gwendolyn, sunlight sitting there a bit, but the civilian male is a civilian acting paymaster. He never went overseas, they never wore uniform, but they had the same status as a captain in the Army Pay Department. The lady looking at me at the moment, she's wearing a blue badge, sorry, a black badge. She is a lady superintendent. She's got the same status as a civilian acting paymaster. So you've got women managers, but equally, you know, you have to give them a little military badge to wear to say, I'm not just a clerk, I'm a lady superintendent, which in those days, a lady superintendent, you would get in the post office and other civil servants, service departments. They were lady managers, for want of a better word. This section here, there's five ladies and one male civilian acting paymaster. They would probably be looking after the accounts of two companies of the Royal Engineers. And it's a wooden hut. They're right in the middle. There's a big bookshelf right to the ceiling. That hut would spread downwards, and you would probably get in one of those huts about 5,000 accounts being kept, and you had 50 huts. And that shows you the expansion of the army. The Royal Engineers became a very large corps. They were brilliant at what they did. Thousands of guys ended up in the Royal Engineers. Some volunteered, some were drafted from other corps and regiments. And if I could just stress that, I have a medal index card for a soldier in the Royal Munster Fusiliers. Regular soldier, he was in the army before 1914. And in 1916, he was transferred to the Labour Corps. And a year later, he was transferred to the Military Foot Police. And a year after that, he was transferred to the Royal Engineers. Now, in those days, you never had an army number, you had a regimental number. Came from your regiment. So if you were the first recruit in a regiment, you had the number one, and it cycled. Now, if you joined the Labour Corps, and nearly a million men served in the Labour Corps, and no one volunteered for it, generally, they were conscripted into it because it was after conscription, or that you were medically downgraded, which I find a bit ridiculous. It's like, Labour Corps, you're going to have, you need strength. But he would have had four changes of record office, four changes of army pay office, and he had four regimental numbers. In 1920, the numbering system of the army changed so that the number you were given was centrally controlled and organized, and wherever you move, say you move from the myself, Royal Army Medical Corps, to the Royal Army Pay Corps, my number stayed the same. Because in that First World War system, if you wanted to lose yourself and evade the military police by giving them false information, you can give them the number, rank, and name of a previous unit that you were with. And equally, there was a paper in the Western Front journal a couple of years ago, I thought was brilliant. This gentleman was writing about his uncle, who had a checkered First World War career because of ill health and other things. And he had about six army pay officers and six regimental numbers. He was honest, he didn't fake it. But I would imagine a lot of deserters and others who wanted to evade the system or escape from their family, a lot did. It was easy to do, but it was a nightmare for army pay officers. Suddenly the post would arrive, an army pay officer would receive 28,000 items by post a week, and there's a set of documents to a name. Well, we got this, and you had to check around all the army pay, or the army pay office, all its records to see why have I got this guy's documents. And you find out 3 weeks later he's been transferred to you. And it was, of course, chaos. And they use young girls, left school 13, but in army pay office at Shrewsbury, they employed part-time the senior girls from the primary school in Shrewsbury as weekend tracers and runners. And you had these, I've 30 years ago, when I started this project, I was given the details of a lady, she was nearly 100, who had been a 13-year-old working at the Dover Army Pay Office, which had 32 campuses, and she was employed on a tracer, as a tracer. She had a bicycle, she had to go all round these campuses, tracing where these people were they part of the Royal Garrison Artillery, or were they someone else? In the meantime, that soldier could have moved on again, could have been killed. And she also had to go round to the next of kin, who had been notified of the death, and give them the paperwork so that they could get a pension. This is the sort of story that a lot of historians miss. Equally, the record offices were very efficient for their day. If anyone's looked at the records, I know so a lot were destroyed in the Second World War or partially destroyed, but they're fairly well kept for the day. They're fairly well kept. They give quite a bit of information. The thing about efficiency and accuracy, if you're looking for an example in the First World War from the British Army's point of view, look no further than the Army Pay Services and the record offices. And they were run by women too.
Now, obviously, many of these women probably become managers of other women, and they get promoted up the ranks. Especially as we know, we're looking at 30,000 individuals. How did these women, I suppose, lead their fellow ladies? And was there any opposition from the former military?
Well, to answer that question, the lady superintendents were modelled on the post office lady superintendents and the post office savings bank lady superintendents. The post office and savings bank were the first state institution to employ women, and they did so from the 19th century. And the women managed the women. And their working arrangements was gender segregated. In the army pay office, they didn't have that luxury, if you could call it a luxury. So men and women had to work together. The women that I've noticed from the scant records that are around, there seemed to be no friction. There was one regimental paymaster called Colonel Stoney. He started life as a subaltern in the Royal Irish Fusiliers. He was born in Woolwich. His father was a colonel in the artillery. And at some point, he volunteered for the to become a paymaster in the Army Pay Department at the turn of the Boer War. And I think he did it because he got promotion quite quickly. So I'm saying he was efficient at his job. But he was working in a system before the 1914, there was no women in the offices. And in 1915, he went off to BEF, Base Pay Office, as a field cashier. Got a mention in dispatches, came home again on promotion, and it was at the Army Pay Office at Aldershot. The Army Pay Office at Aldershot paid the RAMC and the Royal Flying Corps. And I've written a paper about this. It's already it's with the referees at the moment. Stoney became the 2IC of Aldershot Army Pay Office, and it moved, because of shortage of accommodation, it moved to Woking. And at Woking, he was second in command, no problem, everything working, no trouble with women that was ever mentioned in any literature that I've seen, until one day the RAF was being formed. And I think the Aldershot Pay Office was transferred to Woking in 1916 because they were planning an air arm and they wanted a pay office. And I thought, we'll model it on Woking, we'll move it to Woking. And on the same campus as the Army Pay Office, Woking, the Central Pay Office, Royal Air Force, was established with effect from 1st of April 1918. Stoney, from Lieutenant Colonel, became Acting Group Captain, RAF, overnight. Never seen an aircraft in his life. But what he did, the lead up to that, the 6 months previously, he'd been having conferences, meetings with what became the Air Ministry in the Kingsway in London. And he was arrogant about the women. He suggested that, I don't want women in my outfit, I only want men. Women cause problems. Women have off days. And looking at it, he was not quite typical, but there was this degree of eugenic fight psychology around, that women are inferior, their brains can't cope, etc., etc., and all this rubbish. And he and Lord Weir sought the advice of the post office, how were their women treated? And they said, well, we have them segregated. And but what we have is a system called sex rivalry. We have a section of women, one side of the office, with a barrier, a section with men, the other side of the office, doing the same task. Who does it best? Yeah? Now, because in a war, you're going to have accommodation shortages, you haven't got the facilities to have sex discrimination by barriers. And the Army Pay Office at Woking, I thought, probably breathed a sigh of relief when he went up the road. I'm not sure. But what happened was, it settled down. A lot of the women, this is another I haven't resolved. Why was it civilian women only in the Army Pay Offices? But right from the start, in the RAF Pay Office at Woking, they were WRAF. They were in uniform. And I've noticed some photographs that are in the Surrey Heritage Museum at Woking. They've got masses of photographs. And I noticed a lot of them were South Asian women. Yeah, and Woking's got the oldest mosque in England. It was built in the 19th century. You had for a long period of time a South Asian Muslim population in the Woking area. And the women did very well. And you had two types of WRF women. You had the immobiles, that they were lived at home, traveled to the Army Pay Off, so travelled to the RAF pay office, put their uniform on, worked a day's work, changed again and went home. You didn't have that in the army pay offices as far as I know. The women were not in uniform. Some lived at home. Some came from a far distance away. To finish with the Stoney story, I think he made his points known, but I don't think they were universal throughout the army pay services. The scant literature that's around suggests that all senior army paymasters who experienced the First World War were very highly complimentary to the women staff who worked with them. And I think Stoney was the traditional grumpy old man. I would say that he was honoured by being appointed CBE at the end of the war. He retired to Camberley, but died a year later. And that was Colonel Stoney that I found to be a very unique and remarkable character, that he was raising a voice that I haven't found anywhere else. And I'm sure there were infidelities around. I know of a civilian acting paymaster in Preston, the army pay office at Preston, who was a Canadian. He was an accountant and he had a wife and family in Canada, who was having an illicit relationship with a woman clerk, and she became pregnant. And this was October 1918. I've got his personal file. I'm not going to mention his name on the screen, but in his personal file, there's this handwritten memo from the regimental paymaster to the Crown paymaster, who was his superior in Chester, saying, "Mr. So-and-so has got this lady into trouble and he's married. And I've sacked the woman." Yeah, "I've sacked the woman. She's pregnant. Go." And we're going to commission this civilian acting paymaster as a lieutenant assistant paymaster and send him with the North Russian British Expeditionary Force. And that's what happened. Yeah. And I find that remarkable, because it takes two to tango, and a poor lady, young lady perhaps, naive. She came from North Wales, which is a nonconformist Bible belt. Yeah. She's going to be possibly ostracized by her own society, because you know that if you've been pregnant outside of wedlock, you know, horror upon horror, you're going to hell and all this. I often wonder what happened to her. And I did find out that she died in 1962. She never married, and she ran a small holding on the Cheshire Shropshire border, and her sister was the notification of her death. But what I'm saying is, I said this at a women's conference, this lady is just as much a casualty of the First World War as any soldier killed on a battlefield.
I wonder whether we could actually focus on some of the stories of these women. You write about people like Violet Deering and Ethel Cartledge. Tell us about them. And I wonder whether you could also tell us some stories about some of the Muslim ladies from Woking, the Woking area, who worked in the pay office there.
What I would like to do at some point is go back to Woking and see the secretary of the mosque and ask his advice about, has the mosque archives got any record of local families living in that area at the time who may have served in the Women's Royal Air Force? I would say that the Muslim community at Woking is very well established, and I've been told that, you know, that they're welcome any historical research. The mosque, believe it or not, was designed by an Englishman sorry, built by an Englishman on a design by a German. Yeah, I mean, it brings it all together, doesn't it? Yeah, and it's the oldest mosque. It's quite a beautiful building. I've seen it from the outside. And, it's something, how about the Egyptian Labour Corps? They were all Muslim. Their graves are scattered in North France as well. Yeah, everyone was in the same boat. Yeah, and with the women, I don't know much about the Women's Royal Air Force women. One or two little notes in local histories I noticed in Surrey Heritage Centre. It deserves further inquiries. Other ladies that I've known, I would like to know more about the lady superintendent in number one pay office at Preston in 1917. She's the senior lady superintendent. You can tell she's wearing the biggest hat. If you're outside having your photograph taken, all the clerks, civilian clerks, are in white blouses. The lady superintendents, there was normally two of them in the system, wore hats. And she is of African, Caribbean, British heritage. And I've no idea who she is. I've tried the local Lancashire press, who tried very hard for me, but I got no response from anywhere. I think she was married to a senior British Army officer. That's my impression, because she got the job as Lady Superintendent. And I'm wondering, this is just me, was what to say, race discrimination less prominent in the First World War than it was in the Second? I wonder if there's more of an acceptance. Okay, we got buried in, I come from Wiltshire originally, and a village where down the road from where I used to live, my dad was a local policeman. There's some graves from the 4th London Regiment. They were Royal Fusiliers. And two of them came from the Caribbean. And apparently, 80 Caribbean soldiers volunteered to the British Army, landed in early 1915 in London, were paraded by the Mayor of Westminster, and were accepted as, any other soldier. These are brave men. Unfortunately, two of them died of pneumonia in 1916. It's still around, pneumonia, on Salisbury Plain, in one of the camps near Salisbury. And I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, well, I know that there was a Colonel Hamley in Preston who was a he had retired in 1911 from the Army Pay Department, Colonel, been decorated in the South African War. And I know his wife was from what is now Sri Lanka. She was Ceylonese. And he married her in 1874 when he was a lieutenant paymaster in what was called the sub-control department. That's before the Army Pay Department was formed in 1878. She died in 1916, so it's not her, but she doesn't look South or Southeast Asian to me. She's very much African heritage. And I'm still thinking, she's well educated. She has been the wife of a senior army officer. She's handled household accounts. She's handled servants. She's handled functions and networking. And I believe that's how she got the job. Very efficient at her job. But I've no idea who she was. I'd love to know. Before I die, I would love to know who this lady was.
And I think coming to my final question, when we look back at the Army Pay Corps and its experience in the First World War, how would you sum up the legacy of what's there, and what do we need to do to learn more?
Well, the legacy of the Army Pay Services is that the rank structure in the Army Pay Services used to stop at full colonel. Well, in the First World War, it increased to Major General because Major Claude Bray, who formed the Army Pay Active Service Pay Book and the Army Pay Offices, he formulated the idea for one. He became the Paymaster in Chief of the BEF in France, and he was knighted and made a Major General. There was another, Sir John Carter, who was a colonel. He was in charge of the whole of the UK Army Pay Services and used to sit in conferences with generals, Haig and everything like this, as a mere colonel. The king knighted him. He was made also a major general, and he also became in charge of cleaning up the system when it was folded up after the armistice. The Army Pay Department and the Army Pay Corps received royal prefixes. It was Sir John Carter who suggested, why don't you join the two corps up and call it the Royal Army Pay Corps? And that's what happened. There was also a fight. There was a lot of officers, probably regimental officers, who wanted the pay system to go back to what it was before the introduction of Army Pay Offices. You know, and with pay documents all over the globe getting lost. Sir John Carter put his foot down and stopped that. The legacy with the First World War, particularly the women, I have one lady who was a 14-year-old girl working at the Army Pay Office at Worley in Essex. She served as a junior clerk tracer. She went back in 1938 as a part-time member of the Auxiliary Territorial Force, the ATS, sorry, the Auxiliary Territorial Service. And she became an ATS pay clerk in the same office she worked with in the First World War. And I also have another lady at Preston, the same. She formed the Army Pay Corps football team, the girls' football team. I've had a paper published in the Western Front Association Journal last year. And I had an argument with the National Army Museum over it because they still insist that WAAC clerks worked in Army Pay Offices in the UK. And I found no evidence of that. Anyway, this lady also came back in the Second World War as a sergeant in the ATS and worked in the same Army Pay Office. And I managed to get, on payment of a fee, a Second World War record out. And it says previous service, civilian clerk in Army Pay Office Preston, 1915 to 1919. So I held my case. She was a civilian in Preston in the First World War. And I just find what I think the legacy of all this is still needed to be found. I still think it's a hidden history. I've been trying to expose it as best I can. Been searching off and on for it for 30 years. I have found in academia, because I've tried to apply for jobs, using this as a basis of what I can do. Academics found it not that interesting, and I don't know why. Because this is not just military history, this is social history as well. In the Army Pay System, the Separation Allowance System of 1914 to 1919, you will find the beginnings of the welfare state. And I think, you see, my criticism with certain military historians, not all of them, is they put things in boxes, you know, and well, did this influence something else down the line? And they seem to shut the doors on that. And I think the First World War Army pay system actually revolutionized the profession of the military to a reasonably administered army pay system, and a separation allowance system became the model for the post 1948 welfare state. You know, you were paying child allowances in 1916. You know, I think that came about again in the 1970s, the child allowance scheme, child benefit allowance scheme. And no one seemed to hit on it, you know, well, has it been done before? And I think in a lot of history and modern politics, if you look a little bit in your archives, you'll find this has been done before. And it probably a different world and different system, but the basic mechanics are the same. The army pay offices, and the original ones were designed on the first army pay office at Dover. It's called a Dover system. And throughout even my period of time, it was a Dover system. That system lasted until 1993. Yeah. And what caused it to collapse was information technology, the computer age. What we've been talking about was all pencils, index cards, manual compilation of pay records and the like. Now it's all on computer. Even the Royal Army Pay Corps was disbanded. But I do hear from people that have their ears closer to the services than I do, they're now thinking perhaps we should have a dedicated financial corps. Well, they had one, then they got rid of it.
History repeating itself.
Yeah.
John, on that, very, very interesting talk. Thank you very much for your time.
That's okay.
You have been listening to the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Western Front Association with me, Tom Thorpe. Thank you for all my guests for appearing on this edition. The theme music for this podcast was George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow. It was performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Krish Russman, and produced by Biz Records. This recording is part of a collection of orchestral works by Butterworth performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and supported by the Western Front Association. This is available from all good record stores under the record code BIS 2195. Until next time.